Lynn Village. Today is Monday, the 10th August of 1998. In the fireside room this afternoon, we have Chuck Schaefer. Today's session number is 98.5, and it's titled, Can We Understand Genocide in Rwanda? Let's listen in.
And I am a historian of African and Middle Eastern studies at Valparaiso University. I've been there for approximately 4 years, and prior to coming there, both my wife and I were teaching at Addis Ababa University in Ethiopia with the Fulbright program. So thanks to your taxes, we were paid, and paid well. But that was a wonderful experience. And my connection with Africa goes back to birth. My parents were ALC missionaries in Ethiopia. And I suppose if you add all the time that I've lived in Africa, I've been there approximately 14 years, which gives me some a little bit of expertise, I think, to talk about Ethiopia. But when you're teaching about Africa in the United States, you don't have the luxury of concentrating on one country. You have to broaden your perspective and look at the whole continent and teach basically general classes on African history. Unlike when I was a Fulbrighter in Ethiopia, I came and they said, oh good, we're going to slot you into this class. And I said, what class is that? And they said, late 19th century Ethiopian history. And I found out it was the time slot was from 1870 through 1910. And I had to figure out how to come up with a semester worth of classes about 40 years of Ethiopian history. And here I was teaching Ethiopian history to Ethiopians in Ethiopia. Did I feel under pressure? Yes. But in any case, that's an aside. What I want to do today is to concentrate on Rwanda and try to use Rwanda to basically ask the question, can one understand genocide? This past semester, in a class on 20th century world history, instead of talking at length about the Holocaust in Germany, I instead assigned a book by Fergal Keane called A Season of Blood, which is about the Rwandan genocide. And here my students were forced to read about a genocide that happened relatively recently, and all of a sudden we had these amazing discussions about human propensity to perpetuate harm against one another. And it wasn't something that was 50 years old and sort of analyzed and cataloged on library bookshelves, but it was something very real. And I'm hoping we can have a little bit of that discussion here. Now, I realize you haven't read that book and are somewhat of a disadvantage, but I think not at a great disadvantage. So let me just ask some questions to prime you. Now, this photo is not actually from Rwanda. It was when my wife and I were traveling in northern Eritrea in the summer of 94. This was a year after Eritrea had received its independence, and they were just unearthing some extermination camps. And this was one of them that had just been unearthed, and we saw some atrocities that I think were just being sort of excavated. But I think it maybe sort of depicts a little bit about what we're talking about. I'm sure many of you remember the barrage of television media that covered the Rwandan genocide. You also probably saw pictures in Time and Newsweek. If you wanted to remind yourself, just take this magazine. It's by the UNHCR, High Commission for Refugees. And you can get some of those pictures, revive some of those pictures that I'm sure are stored in your consciousness. But what? Let me just prime you a little bit. What do you remember about the Rwandan genocide?
Bodies in the river.
Yes. Can somebody describe those bodies?
Mutilated, tortured, shot.
Hacked, mutilated, tortured, shot. Yeah. What color were they? Were they? Weren't they almost bleached? I saw some of these photos where there were some black bodies washing down the river or on the landscape, but oftentimes they were almost bleached, and you know, it was sort of a shock to my consciousness, you know, about race disparity and all that. Does anybody remember when the genocide was?
I'm going to stab it. Late 80s?
Late 80s.
So.
Stab. Anybody else? When was that genocide?
During a political changeover, wasn't it 2 or 3 years? 3 years ago?
3 years ago. That would be 95?
92.
94. 94, yes. Do you sort of remember what months that all or? Oh, good. Well, good. It started on the 7th of April in 1994 and stopped sometime in the first or second week of July of the summer of 94. Do you remember who killed whom?
Hutus were killing the Tutsis first and then vice versa.
Pardon? The Hutu were killing the Tutsis and then I didn't hear?
And the Tutsis tried to leave.
Yeah, so there's reprisals about the Hutu and the Tutsis. These are two ethnic groups, and certainly we'll talk about them a little bit more. Does anyone remember, well, I guess I gave that one away. I was going to say, does anyone remember how long it lasted? And I already told you, 3 months. Almost 100 days, actually. Does anybody know how many people died? Close to a million, please. There's various estimates. Some say that maybe 500,000 people died, 500,000 in those 3 months. A lot of people are beginning to indicate that maybe it was more like 800,000. I have heard estimates of 1 million. But just to give you sort of some ideas, if it was 500,000, that meant 42,000 people were being killed per week, or 6,000 per day. If it was 1 million, that means 84 million people were being killed every week, and 12 million people almost every day. These are extraordinary numbers.
12,000,
yes, I'm sorry. 12,000 per day. These are extraordinary numbers. At the height of the Holocaust, which was somewhere in 1944, the Nazis executed 400,000 Jews and Gypsies and Poles and people who they executed in a 3 month period. So by the lowest estimate, the genocide in Rwanda took more lives in a more condensed period of time than at the height of the Nazi regime in Europe. What were some of the differences between the Holocaust and the Rwandan situation? Let's talk about the Holocaust. What was the nature of genocide in the Holocaust?
Racial prejudice,
very much so. Scapegoating, very much so. How were the executions actually done?
Gas
chambers, shot. Yeah, they were shot at the very beginning, gas chambers.
Worked to death.
Pardon?
Worked to death.
Starved, yeah. Where was the locus of this genocide?
Out of sight.
Exactly. Thank you. Out of sight. In other words, what the Nazi regime did was create sort of killing factories where people were taken by railroad, they were taken to these factories, these extermination camps, and nobody really saw them. You've all probably had, or at least touched, the Holocaust studies in some of your education to this point, and it's probably correct a significant proportion of the German population really wasn't aware of what was going on. And I think that is fair to say. The closest the majority of those who did know what was going on got to the actual extermination was to snitch on a neighbor, to rat on some Jews who maybe lived down the block, and you know, to point out, and then the Gestapo would come and they would be taken away. Even the people who were in like Buchenhain or some of the other extermination camps, there's a great debate about just who they were and what they did and how sort of culpable they are. A professor called Christopher Browning, actually, he taught at Pacific Lutheran until this last year, when he was made a named professor of Holocaust studies at University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. He wrote a book a number of years ago called Ordinary Men. And what he was arguing is that those who were carrying out the genocide in Hitler's regime were just sort of recruited from the rank and file. Sometimes they were postal workers. Sometimes they were just local gendarmerie or, you know, policemen who were just recruited in and then made these executioners. On the other hand, there's been a recent book that came out about 2 years ago that took the same group of people from the same village that Chris Browning talks about, and the title of this man's book is called Hitler's Willing Executioners. So there's this sort of debate about the culpability of who was involved. But Rwanda was a total different story. What was the favorite weapon of extermination in Rwanda?
The machete.
Yeah, the machete or the club. In fact, at the very beginning, when the executions were a little bit more organized, and when this sort of militia, this Hutu militia, was running around with their AK-47s, there are ample stories that women actually would either save enough money or somehow go down to the market and purchase the, I think it's an 8mm round of ammunition that fits in the AK-47, purchase those rounds of ammunition with their last bits of saving and keep them with them in their bra or wherever, sometimes on their body, so that when they were found, the Tutsi women would present the bullets to the Hutu militia and say, please kill my children with this. Please shoot them in the head like that, because that's such a gracious, quick death in comparison to being whacked over the head multiple times, oftentimes with blunt machetes or clubs. And so, you know, the gruesomeness of the thing is quite extraordinary. Let me read you a passage from Harper's Magazine. This is April 1997. There's an article entitled, Judgment Day. In Rwanda, 92,392 genocide suspects await a trial. But he goes on to explain much here. If Nazis ran killing factories that most Germans never had to confront directly, Rwandans murdered intimately, scattered their clothes with the blood of their neighbors. A UN survey of 3,000 children after the war showed that 69.5% had watched murders or maimings. These are children. 78.5% had heard screams, and 16% had hidden under corpses. Whoa. Nobody knows how many people actually took part in the slaughter, but without gas chambers and crematoriums, the number of executioners had to be far greater than in Germany. There are stories about many students killing their teachers. Why? Because many Tutsis tended to be a little bit better educated and filled the ranks of the educational establishment and most bureaucratic positions. Conversely, there are also evidence of a couple Tutsi teachers taking a gun into the classroom and killing some of their Hutu students. Fergal Keane in Seasons of Blood, that book I was mentioning before, references a Catholic priest who locked himself and orphans, he ran an orphanage, in a church and to protect them, thinking that he was going to be the shelter, be that buffer between the executioners and his orphan children, his orphan Tutsi children, and he was incinerated along with the children in the church. What is sort of frightening for me to contemplate is that approximately 90% of Rwandans are Christian. By 90% of the Rwandan population was Christian. Hutus and Tutsis, yes, very much so. In fact, many people went to the churches because the churches, they thought, if there's going to be sanctuary anywhere, it's got to be in the nave of the church. And so people fled to churches. And then the Hutu began to key on the churches. And the churchyards, the churches themselves and the churchyards became the killing fields. The density of dead bodies around churches surpassed almost every other place in the country of Rwanda. One Tutsi woman, this is also in Fergal Keane's The Season of Blood, one Tutsi woman buried herself and her young daughter under a heap of cadavers in a churchyard and was rescued 3 days later, only to find that her daughter, who was alive when she buried herself, and her daughter had died sometime in that period in her own arms. I mean, when you're thinking of the dislocation of the horrors, the Rwandan genocide almost defies imagination. For those of you who are passing around that publication by the UNHCR called Refugees, just take a look at the pictures of it. Right in the center, there's a nice map that shows you what was going on there. And people were fleeing all over the place. The radio, in fact, seems to have been the vehicle that incited the Hutu to go out and to oftentimes kill their neighbors, oftentimes Tutsi neighbors who they had intermarried with. This is called ethnic miscegenation. There's a dominant group and a not so dominant group, and or two different tribes or ethnicities, and they marry together. Ethnic miscegenation had been going on in Rwanda and Burundi and many of those other Central African countries around Lake Victoria for a long time. And people then felt compelled to oftentimes go to their next door neighbor who they were related to and kill them.
Same thing happened in Bosnia also.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
Could you give us a sense of the geographic size of Rwanda and the population?
I'll do that in about two more seconds. I have a map hidden behind here of my own cartography, so it is accurate to an extreme. No, I'm joking. The radio, oftentimes, I said, was this thing that incited people. In this same article, this is just sort of beyond the pal. This reporter is in the prisons. He's interviewing one of these Rwandans who has fessed up to killing two kids, two six-year-old siblings. with a blunt machete, which he had pound or blunt club, in which he had pounded nails and then lopped off the ends of them so they were sort of spikes. And he took it and killed two 6-year-old children. And this is what he said: "I asked the obvious question, how could you kill children?" His response: "If you were there, things in things were strange. I can't find any way to explain it to you. Can you imagine the radio saying, 'Go kill these people'? The message got to the local authorities. They mobilized the soldiers and the militias, and they were going to the village, getting citizens to kill. As we accepted, they said we were fighting for the country." And then the interviewer is asking, "What could have happened if you had refused?" He looked bewildered, tugging at the sleeve of his mangy red blazer. "Nobody refused." It's amazing. The irony is that this man that he was interviewing, his first name is Innocent. But it was just a travesty. Certainly, we are, as we said at the very beginning, we saw the images of dead bodies floating down the rivers. Oftentimes they had to float down distances, and on Lake Kivu, the whole shoreline was sometimes stricken with, it almost looked like everybody was sunbathing, just bodies piled up along the shoreline. They would oftentimes float through Uganda and through Tanzania to Lake Victoria. Lake Victoria has lots of alligators, lots of hippos. Supposedly the alligators were so bloated, they were not going after the cadavers at that time, which I think is sort of a little bit.
Question on Rwanda, were they having economic problems prior to this?
Yeah, I'll get to that. Okay. Yeah, I think that's part of my explanation. Could you close that slide projector there? Just turn it off. There's sort of a button at the back there. And here's my made for some map. Here. Well, I didn't say that. But here's a map of Africa in small. And what you have over here is this huge country called Zaire. You have Kenya over here. Somalia comes up over here. Ethiopia's right in here. Tanzania, Uganda, Rwanda right over there, and Burundi. So if we enlarge that, you see this colossus of a country called Zaire, also a Belgian colony. Both Rwanda, the one in red here, and Burundi were Belgian colonies. Uganda, oops, I forgot to put the A there. Uganda was a British colony, Kenya was a British colony, Tanganyika was a German colony, it became a British colony after World War I. So what do you have? You have Lake Victoria over here, and you can see that the bodies probably had to either float down through parts of Uganda or through this sort of portion of Tanzania to get to Lake Victoria. Lake Kivu, and actually this is supposed to be up there, never mind. Lake Kivu was just dotted with these bodies. The population of Rwanda, I don't know the exact population. I believe it's in excess of maybe around 15 million. And it's very small land mass, and both Rwanda and Burundi are the most populated areas of Africa. In fact, they raid up there with parts of Indonesia, with Sumatra and the island of Java, in terms of density of population, and Holland. You know, Holland is the most densely populated of the European states. And so it rates way up there in terms of the density of population, which will bring me at the very end to talking about economics and all of that kind of stuff. Well, where do we begin in trying to understand genocide? The explanation that is around all over the place. In fact, you can go right out in the hall here and pick up one of these, Good Courage, a publication of Holden Village. And on page 4, there is a good article called Genocide in Rwanda. But this article and so many other articles I have read are filled with details, but I believe are a little bit simplistic in the analysis. Carol Berkland says, the answer is a rather simple one. Genocide, whether in Rwanda or anywhere else, is usually the result of racial or ethnic hatred and the unprincipled political exploitation of these hatreds. I believe, I agree with the last part of that sentence, but I don't necessarily agree with the ethnic cleansing idea. But let me just try to articulate the basis of this ethnic cleansing explanation. About 1,000 years ago, there was a massive migration from somewhere in West Africa, and these are called the Bantu migrations. And one went down here through Zaire, down into southern Africa, and another went sort of over the top of Zaire into parts of East Africa. And the Hutu are believed to be descendants of the Bantu. They are darker, they are shorter, they're more Negroid in feature, and they are, they have been there at least probably 1,000 years. The Tutsi are, we don't know their origin. There's these old sort of archaeological, ethno-archaeological people who say, well, yeah, but they're descendants from the Hamitic, the Hamites, or the Cushitic, or the Nilotic. And as far as I know, it seems to me that these groups are sort of a depiction of a taller racial group that is more thin, whose noses tend to be more Semitic in that they're long and a little bit more narrow. In any case, the Tutsi tend to be a little bit taller and lighter skinned than the Hutu. Now, it's apparent that before colonialism took place in the scramble for Africa in around the 1880s, the Tutsi dominated over the Hutu, even though they were the minority. The Tutsi are approximately 20% of the population, the Hutu about 80%, and they seem to have dominated. But even that is sort of uncertain, because up here in Uganda, you have some very, very powerful lake civilizations, the Buganda and the Bunyoro, and they were Bantu in origin, and they had the Tutsi as sort of vassals to them. Now, would they ally with their brothers, the Hutu? I'm not quite certain. So there's a lot of things that we just don't know about that pre-colonial period. In any case, by the end of the 19th century, early 20th century, Zaire, Rwanda, and Burundi were all dominated by the Belgians. And the Belgian imperialism was perhaps the most rapacious of all the colonial powers in Africa. Originally, for about 30 years, Zaire, this whole country of the Congo, was the personal property of King Leopold II. It wasn't part of, the Belgian government was separated from that. That was his personal property to exploit as he wanted. And all he was interested in was padding his pocketbook, and human rights were at the lowest of his concern. There is a railroad from one falls on the Congo River to another falls where they say that per tie of railroad, 5 Congolese died in the construction of that railroad. This was the nature of Belgian colonialism. In any case, they go into Rwanda and Burundi and find these nice, tall, sort of aristocratic-looking Tutsi and the shorter Africans, that more flat nose and all that, and being of 19th century European affinity, they gravitated to the Tutsis. They recruited them into the lower ranks of their administration. In fact, there were some missionary schools that only allowed Tutsis in, not Hutus. They only educated Tutsis because they thought they were more sort of higher on the social sort of scale of civilization. So what does this do? I think this maybe 70 to 80 year period of colonialism sort of creates ethnicity. It solidifies a lot of this barrier. And one of the key ingredients in this is the issuance of ID cards. Everybody had to carry an ID card. And on that ID card was a little H for Hutu, or a T for Tutsi. This, you know, all of a sudden, you looked at that and you wondered, well, what does that mean? Well, that means somebody arbitrarily decides that you are a Hutu or a Tutsi. Now, this is extremely difficult, and to sort of arbitrarily do that, to create ethnicity. It's something that is sort of hard to undo. In any case, where are we? I think Carol Berkland is sort of looking at that proto-history, at that colonial history, and many others like her are looking at that and ossifying, that is, making concrete those ethnic distinctions and playing upon them to today. But it's a lot more complex than that. And so in this next phase, what I want to do is give you a little bit of the history with a few dates. Now I know as a historian, this is almost suicide because usually people start going, you mentioned 19 this, 19 that, and everybody's just sort of, you know, nodding. But I'll try to be brief about it. 1961, the Belgians leave. They just leave Zaire. The French at West Africa had gone independent in 1960. Belgians were caught napping. They thought, shoot, we better get out of here. We don't want to be caught with a rebel secessionist civil war going on. Let's just leave. And they leave Zaire, they leave Rwanda, they leave Burundi, just like that. The fact is, when they left Zaire, this huge country, there was one Zairean who had a BA education, the equivalent of a BA education, and that was in history. Everybody else was maybe, there was quite a few with high school educations, but one person who had a BA education, and they thrust government everything onto an underpopulated undereducated populace who is then supposed to rule according to the sort of the protocol of the most sophisticated Western nations. In fact, that one guy with the BA education in history, I think, became the ambassador to the United Nations and moved to New York City. So he wasn't even in Zaire. They did this sort of the same thing with Rwanda and Burundi. In Rwanda, they held elections in 1961 so quickly that nobody really had a chance to mobilize. So what happened? The Tutsi had been favored, that had been sort of mentored, who they had been sheltered, they had been sort of given all the perks of the system. When this election was called, the Hutu voted for Hutu, and 83% of the population voted in the Hutu. At that point, almost 800,000 Tutsi flee into Rwanda, or into Uganda, sorry. And they become the nucleus of what is called the RPF, the Rwandan Patriotic Front, and we'll come back to that.
They moved into Uganda.
Into Uganda. They flee because of the elections, because they were out of power. These are the Tutsi.
So the Hutus,
who are the majority, who are weren't even educated, took over government. What happens in the interim? Well, you know, it, like most African countries, it sort of bobbles along a little bit. And we have, and then the next time we hear about Rwanda is I think from Sigourney Weaver playing Diane Fossey in Gorillas of the Mist. Did any of you see that movie?
Yeah.
So that is the country we're talking about, really. That's that beautiful canopy of luscious green forests. I mean, it's really beautiful. And that's where the big silverback gorillas live. And in the late 80s, early 90s, they really began to develop ecotourism, where people were going to Rwanda and looking, taking these little tours, these little safaris into these forests and seeing these big silverbacks. I remember in Ethiopia in 93, some friends of ours, Jeff and Eileen, were talking about that Christmas having gone there and having had a fabulous time in Rwanda. And they said that hotels were great, food was great, everything was great. Why don't you go? And so my wife and I were actually thinking of going sometime during in the early 90s to Rwanda just to see the silverbacks, and because it was supposed to be such a great place. Well, what happens? This overlooks, I think, what's really going on. In 1990, the RPLF, with the backing of the Rwandan government, start coming back into Ugandan government started coming back into Rwanda, and there is a civil war from 90 to 93, at which point nobody wins. There's a ceasefire, and they all go to Arusha, a little town over here in Tanzania, to work out a peace accord. In fact, my brother-in-law lives in Arusha. My wife's brother has been living there since 1977. My wife's family were medical missionaries in Tanzania, and some of the offspring of these medical missionaries just can't get Africa out of their veins, and so they stay. I can't get it out of my veins, so I teach about it. They go to Arusha and try to work out this accord. One last bit of information before we get to the very brink of the genocide. In October of 1993, the Burundi, there's a major Pierre, oh, what's his name? I guess that Pierre, well, now that I mention it, Pierre Bunyoyo, and he is a military person. He's a Tutsi, but he thinks, you know, maybe it's time for a elected president. And so he organizes these elections, and lo and behold, Burundi is also, the majority of people are Hutu, and they vote in a Hutu president, the first freely elected Hutu president in Burundi. Shortly thereafter, in October, that Hutu president is killed in Burundi, and all of a sudden there's a lot of fermentation against the Hutu in Burundi, and 700,000 are, yes, 700,000 of them flee into Rwanda. Now, you can see that, you know, you have Hutu coming in from Burundi over here, you have Burundi or Tutsi coming in from Uganda over here. The people are just sort of thinking, what's going on? This is sort of the political explanation of it all. What's going on? And then, to top it off, the president of Rwanda, on April 6th, 1994, is flying back from Arusha, having just signed the Arusha Peace Accords that
fabricate a lasting ceasefire between the RPF and the Hutu government in Rwanda. He's flying back with the president, this new puppet president of Burundi in his plane, and the plane is shot down over the airport of Kigali. The next day the genocide starts, and the next 100 days you know about, 1 million people die. Well, what was the U.S. doing? We knew about it almost from the very get-go. We were so shell-shocked from our experiences in Somalia that we were hesitant to move in. Then the United Nations contacted us and asked, well, could we lease your soldiers and your vehicles and your armored personnel carriers? And the reason American forces, the 5th Special Forces, which is, you know, like our Green Beret, and they were deployed in that area. They could have got in there easily within a short amount of time and probably squelched this thing. The reason they didn't was we were arguing over the per diem costs of an American soldier going into Rwanda and how much the United Nations was willing to rent our military vehicles for. And that's the truth. We were arguing over cents as opposed to bodies. Well, what about the French? The French were actually giving the Hutu armaments. And this was under the aegis of the great socialist president, François Mitterrand, and his son is particularly implicated in this. So, you know, we in the West aren't quite innocent of this, I guess. So, back to the issue. Is ethnicity enough of an explanation? And I'm uncertain. Again, going to Carol Berkland's conclusion, she says, the genocide in Rwanda again reinforces the terrible lesson that when racial and ethnic hatreds are used to justify political and social exclusion, sooner or later the hatreds that have built up in these excluded may easily be manipulated by unscrupulous politicians for their own self-interest and political survival. True. But the issue of ethnicity isn't sufficient. And I was a United Nations election observer in Ethiopia in June of 1992, and I was deployed right down,
I suppose the Ethiopian border sort of goes like this. Sort of like this, and there's a little chute that goes off like that, and this is Gambela here, and I was looking at electioneering right here, and this is the Sudan, and it was one of the worst places to be in Ethiopia. Come to my slideshow on Wednesday, and you can see slides about how hot the Cold War was in Africa. In any case, what I learned at that time was the following, that ethnicity is this incredibly malleable, elastic, all process that's always in the process of being formed and then reformed. What tangible evidence do I have to this? For the first time in Ethiopia in 1992, people had to put on their election document what ethnic group they belonged to. Now, later on when I was teaching there, I asked one of my students about it, and he says, you know, my grandparent on one side is a Tigrinian. My other grandparent is Amhara. I have a grandparent who's Oromo, and another one that is sort of African traditional, one of the southern tribes. So what does that make me? On all four grandparents come from different ethnic groups. There's been so much intermarriage between these, and all of a sudden I am required to pick out which group I belong to. Now, if this kid had picked out Tigrinian, he would probably be in a government post right now.
If he had picked Oromo, he'd probably be out in the bush fighting for his independence. He picked Amhara, and so he's just sort of treading in the middle right now. But this is, and what this has done to Ethiopia is catastrophic. 90 years in Ethiopia, 90 years of the 20th century have been devoted to creating a sense of Ethiopian ethnicity, Ethiopian identity. The last 7 years have been given over to creating tribal or ethnic identity. And that has sort of whitewashed everything that has gone before. Instead of being able to say, I am Ethiopian, now you have to say, I am Tigrinian, I am Sidamo, you know, all the ethnic groups, and there's tons of them, down to minutia. Well, I think this is what's happening in much of Africa. And what I think we need to understand is a more inclusive analysis of politics. And some French social scientists looked at Africa and they invented this sort of new analysis called politique de ventre, which means belly politics. How does one satisfy the belly? And essentially what they were doing was looking at resources. What are the resources available? So I'm getting to your question, is there an economic point to this? Yes, there is. I think it's central. They're looking for resources. They're looking at climate, they're looking at environment, they're looking at population growth, and they're adding all of these into this collection of things. And what they find is that there's this old cyclic circle. When you have population growth, you get deforestation, you get soil erosion. That claim changes the climate, that further enhances food disparity, and then you get famine. I mean, this is what we experienced in Ethiopia for many, many times. And Africa is going through the most intense population bomb. Fertility rates are about 6.6 in some countries, which means each woman is having over six live babies. What does this mean? What resources are available in Africa? Well, let me put that as a question to involve you. What resources, from your mind, does Africa have available to it?
Oil.
Nigeria. That's one country. Yeah. Right. But oil, you have palm oil grown all over West Africa. But so that's another resource. Other resources that Africa has available.
Copper.
Coal. Tourism.
Coal.
Coal.
Or zinc.
Zinc, yes. Yeah, zinc.
Crops.
Pardon?
Crops. Cocoa bean.
Yeah, cocoa bean. Some other crops.
Cotton.
Cotton.
Diamonds.
Tea. Tea. Coffee.
Diamonds.
Diamonds, yeah.
Yes.
Can anybody sort of distill everything that's been mentioned here and put it into one category?
Export
goods, yeah.
Extraction
resources.
Expendables, yeah. Or what we call primary goods. You know, these are all things that are exported. There's nothing that's really manufactured or renewable in that list of things that we've been talking about. And so the French were sort of looking at this cotton that is suffering this intensive population growth. And they're saying, well, where are the resources? And then they began to look at the state. And what they found was that belly politics is the analysis of the state. What does the state, you know, the government in America do for us? How do we think of the government? What is it supposed to do?
Referee, sets the rules.
Sets rules, referee, yeah. Politics, negotiation, right.
Pardon? Infrastructure.
Infrastructure, builds roads to serve the people, yeah.
Enhances.
Huh?
Enhances the defense.
Yeah.
It stays forever.
Yeah. Provides it also provides supposedly protection, defense. So in some ways, it's there to serve the people, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But, well, except we have to serve them with the taxes, which are a little bit aggrieving
especially on April 15th.
But the state in Africa is conceived of something totally different. It is a resource itself. It is, the state is Africa's last, most reliable, self-sustaining resource. Why? Because in an environment where population exceeds the carrying capacity of the land and people can't put food on their table, the state always can. Especially if you're part of the state. A state government can always go to IMF or World Bank and get a loan to buy food or just get food. They can always sort of claim there's famine and get donations from American grain or Canadian grain to come. And there's always going to be enough to feed the people who are part of the state. And so what one has in the analysis of politique de vente is an analysis that there is enormous competition for control over the state, because control over the state is the only way to guarantee that you're going to have enough food to feed yourself. And so then politics becomes, how do I ally with people that are going to allow me to monopolize the state? And this is where either regionalism or ethnicity fits in. In other words, if I'm going to use the machete or a club or the AK-47, which is favored, and beat the rest of you and control the state, I can't do it individually. So I need a bigger sort of association of alliances that will enable me and my friends to have control of the state. And what has come to pass in country after country is that ethnicity is the easiest thing. Carol Berkland is absolutely right. It is often the politicians or those who are striving for power who recast ethnicity to fit their political objective. Why? Not because ethnicity has historical roots or anything. It's just the most amorphous, easiest way to galvanize people and promise them something. And the promise is not that we are greater, we, the ethnic group, is greater, but that we will give you food for your children, which is that whole economic issue that comes to play. So in understanding Rwanda, you have to understand it's an incredibly dense population. You have to understand the very few resources it has. It has coffee, it has ecotourism. Ecotourism at its height provided maybe about $10 to $15 million a year. That's it. You know, when you're dealing with a population of 10 to 15 million people, that's peanuts, that's nothing. $1 per person, nobody can live on.
Historically, what do they live on?
Agriculture, and over the years, export. And so Rwanda has been exceedingly impoverished. But what complicates it is a population boom and a doubling rate. You know, if I talk about, I think the most dramatic way is to talk about doubling rates. And Rwanda, in the time up to 1994, had doubled its population in the last 18 years. And so in that 18 years, the competition for state, the competition for feeding yourself, became exceedingly acerbated. And then when you got movements of 800,000 trying to move back in, and 700,000 that you just were inviting in, and all of them are sort of riled up because of ethnicity, that just was like a match to a bird, to, you know, a pile of pine needles just blew up. So I think I've probably spoken quite a bit, but I think in conclusion, what you need is a more inclusive analysis that includes the environment, that includes population or demography into the equation.
How does AIDS factor into this? I mean, is AIDS spreading also amongst this group?
Oh, it's special, Uganda is suffering AIDS. The AIDS pandemic in Uganda is ravaging. In Rwanda and Burundi, it's ravaging. But how do you differentiate AIDS from malaria, from outbreaks of cholera, from tuberculosis is just going through the roof in that area. And so, you know, those are easily more easier to diagnose than AIDS itself. And so I think AIDS, especially in Rwanda in the current situation, nobody's even taking records at all.
I'm sorry, what?
Nobody's even taking records about who's dying from AIDS in Rwanda at this point. Any other questions?
How do you spell politique du ventre?
Politique du ventre.
Two
words. D-E, ventre, V-E-N-T-R-E, I think.
Question. You said earlier they were Christian populations primarily.
Yeah.
Is there birth control teaching, or is there non-teaching of birth control? Or?
Well, let's put it this way. Who was before Pope John Paul I? Wasn't it Pope Paul VI? Uganda had been one of the Catholic Church's experimental sites under his reign, where they were saying, you know, maybe contraception should be used. And then we got John Paul II, and he said, no contraception anywhere. Now that experiment went awry, and so, yeah, there is some birth control, and the population or fertility rates do seem to be going down dramatically, but a lot of that is caused by AIDS too, because it's killing off many, many hundreds of people. There was a long article in the New York Times about AIDS, especially in Zimbabwe, and the statistics are just dramatic. Pardon?
Is it 1 in 4?
Oh, I think it's even more than that.
Worse than that.
I think it's like maybe 60% of people, sexually active people, have contracted AIDS or HIV.
That's right.
HIV.
That's right. It is.
Yeah.
But isn't there some natural selection going on too? Also, apparently, some people are immune to the AIDS.
Yeah, but that's, you know, before that is really, really worked out, I think the death rate is just going to zoom way, way up there.
What where are these discussions going on about the, you know, what kind of aid America could or could not give? Were they going on in the administration?
In the administration and State Department versus and State and Defense Department versus the United Nations. And what the United States really did not want to do is be drawn into another Somalia where their soldiers would be killed and the photographs would be shown on CNN. It's called the CNN factor.
Right.
And the CNN factor really sort of dictates how we relate to Africa and much of the third world now. Now that the Cold War is over, we have no sort of strategic interest in Africa whatsoever. So the only thing we want to do is exploit them every day, but besides that, not be drawn into any tricky situations that will galvanize the American public to write to their congressmen. And Somalia did that. And the administration and Defense Department were going to great lengths to disavow themselves from participation in Rwanda.
You know, the popular press showed that an awful lot of so-called, you know, church people, priests and others, participating in the killing of the other kind of, and you know, the whole question of what factor or how easy it is to override a Christian commitment, which must be easy to override, I guess, given the horrendous numbers that were killed.
Yeah.
But it's hard to understand that.
Yeah, well, I agree. Yeah.
And
I think the sort of the point I was trying to make to my class this last spring when we read A Season of Blood is the fact that, you know, boy, maybe all of us at some sort of level could be persuaded to do atrocities, and that maybe as Christians, maybe what we need to do is just at least be aware of that and fight against. In other words, I'm not sure what it is, what component of human nature compels people to do atrocious things like that. But certainly, Christians were implicated in this genocide in Germany, their exterminations in Stalinist Russia. There's been ample, the Armenian situation, there's been ample situation. Huh, pardon? Yeah. Ample evidence of Christians turning on other Christians. And what I sort of fear is that this genocide, along with many of the others in the 20th century, is going to be forgotten.